Nacho is dedicated to Andreas. And I would like to talk about reflexive groups, and since it's not everybody's cup of tea, I will first say a little bit about the history of this area. This is very much related to what Heike just drew on the board. Then I'll say a few words about a selection of judges, very proper subset of contributions by Andreas Blass to this area. And then I will come to the main aim of the talk about the compositions of those groups related to what Gabriel Sabak suggested. And then I would like to explain how one can use Martin's axiom, getting rid of homomorphisms, and we come to the main theorem, which is a topic. So we begin with Nanke, Roche, Aaron Meckler, Katsuya Eder, and Sharon Schellach. Like in the linear algebra, the dual of a vector space are the Homs, the linear maps into the ground field, where here is not a field, it's the ring of integers, and you usually denote this by a star. And these are the dual groups on those groups which are isomorphic to those things. If you attach a second star, so you have a double dual, then as a gift you get a natural map, the evaluation map, which often is just nothing, so really it's a zero map, which is defined by, it's the usual way. And that image acts on M star, and it acts like this by just reversing the elements. So this thing acts on a Y by throwing this away and you just let the Y act on X. And if it turns out that this group is, this map is an isomorphism, then these groups are called reflexive groups. That's a notion which goes back to Hyman Bass in the 60s. And so when you think about this, you immediately say, okay, there are examples of reflexive groups which are being groups of finite, free being groups of finite rank. Naturally, like vector spaces of finite dimension. If it's infinite, well, things might blow, because the dimension might go up. But it is a little bit different in this area, because there is a theorem, there's a theorem by Bosch, and notion by Bosch, slender groups, and if you rewrite this a little bit, then you notice if you take a cardinal, which is less than the first measurable cardinal, then a Cartesian product of copies of the integers, and at the same time a direct sum of copies of the integers of the free group of rank kappa, they are reflexive groups. So this is using Wash's theorem. Well, count examples are a lot, every group you can think of. It's not. So for the next years, this mainly at the end of the 70s and the 80s, people were interested in showing that this class of reflexive group is not that small as you might think, or they are not just the free groups below the first measurable cardinal and the Cartesian products. So first of all, in the trivial observation, reflexive groups are dual groups. So you could ask, can you reverse this error? And the answer is no. So there are dual groups which are not reflexive. And there's a construction going back to Aaron Meckler and Schlitt in the 80s. They constructed inverse direct limits. So you have maps in two directions and take their direct sum and then a clever embedding of subgroups below to in this generalized Beer-Stecker group, this Cartesian product. And then you end up with a group which is a dual group, but it's not reflexive. The construction at the same time by and Ota is pretty nice. You just prepare a topological space and look with a clever topology, and you look at the continuous functions into the integer. And that's another counterexample. All this you find in the Eklof, in the old, in the new version of the Eklof Mac. In the old and the new version of the Eklof Mekla book on almost 3 modules. Okay. No. Eda extended Wash's theorem, namely taking care of the fact that above the first measurable cardinals, I may have ultrafilters which give rise to linear maps, and also there's a generalized version of Wash's theorem with the impact that you can show that, this is well known, that if kappa is any cardinal but not measurable, then the Cartesian product of those many copies of the integers is still reflexive. So there's one question left over, but I can go to this side. Omega measurable, yeah, that's right. And there was this question, what happens at omega measurable cardinals, which appears as a problem in the new Eklof-Mekla book, in a paper which will appear next year by Sarah Svela, you will find an example of a subgroup we are mu is a measurable cardinal of this Cartesian product of cardinality mu, so it's measurable, which is reflexive. It's in a paper which will appear in the Algebra Universalis, and the paper is on reflexive abelian groups and measurable cardinals and saturated mat families. So this will come out next year. So that's about basic things which happened over the last years. And yet there's a neat trivial and easy observation that this class of reflexive group is closed under direct summands, direct products, and direct sums. So if you start out with just the integers and you close this up under these 3 closure operators, then you end up with a class of groups which is called the Reed class. And this Reed class is fairly large because there's an extension of a theorem by Chase, proved in the early 80s by Dugas and Berger Zimmermann, showing that this class is really large. Namely, when you think of this built up by transfinite induction, at every step you get really a new group into the thing which is not isomorphic to earlier planet. So, also this is one. But still, this is not the end of the story. There's a paper by Kamo Ota, namely, if you can take just continuous function on the rationals with values in the integers, with a discrete topology, then this is not a member of the Reed class, but it's still reflexive. So this class does not exhaust everything. Moreover, if you take a sentence like, just take at your universe groups, abelian groups of cardinality all of one, and require that the all of one separable, which means every countable subgroup sits in a free summand, then asking whether this class is reflexive or not is independent of ZFC. So there you are at the borderline where things really set theory plays in a very crucial role. Now, all these results, and also some of those results by Andreas Blass, they contribute to the showing that this class of groups is fairly large. So Heike already mentioned the Claude Laflamme paper with Andreas. Now I was very much interested in this because there's a kind of construction you can see here. You can show that under Martin's axiom, if you extend a little bit the Walsh notion of slenderness, you will have 2 to the aleph zero many different versions of slender groups. And there are three, we were able only to find 3 or 4, it depends how you count. And then, that Burkhard Wald and I had done this in the beginning of the 80s. And then fortunately this paper came out showing that there are universes in which you have no more than these 4. We always thought, oh, this is because of our stupidity, we are not good enough to create another example of slender groups. It simply didn't work. And there are other results which are related to reflexivity. Well, there are these cardinal characteristics, and there's a paper on bear meets bear, because often in this area you end up with questions related to the bear's category theorem. And at one occasion, Andreas and I looked at the Bayes Becker groups as proper subgroups where you have few endomorphisms. There are always endomorphisms around because they have projections on the Cartesian product to the finite domain components. You never get rid of those. But on the other hand, so if you can minimize the number of those homomorphisms, but you can, if you pick the subgroup in a clever way, in a good way, you can still have a big dual. So then there are other papers on this Becker group, and there's a paper on the Nöbeling group, and I should mention that. Well, Nöbeling will celebrate next week his 100th birthday. So at Erlangen University, we will have a big event, a Nöbeling event next week. So. Okay, so most of the thing, and the point on this result is that they tell you that this class is large or it uses set theory in order to tell you about the size of this class, but only a few results tell you about the particular structure of those reflexive groups. How do they look like? Well, if you have a Cartesian product like the Bayes-Becker group, you can cut it in the middle and you can do various things, but this doesn't tell you very much. So the motivation of my talk are 2 theorems, and one is the starting point was a question by Gabriel Sabac from Paris. Instead of writing down the question, I will I just quote the answer in a paper by Paul Eklof and Sharon Schellach. Namely, and this is about groups in general, abelian groups in general. When you find an abelian group with a property that if you take your favorite natural number, say 2, if you add 1 copy of 2 of the integers to this group, it's not isomorphic to M, but if you add a second copy, it's isomorphic. If you add a third copy, it's not isomorphic, and so on. This is a kind of, if you have seen this Kapansky-type question on strange decompositions of abelian groups, which were in the center in this area. It's beginning of the 60s, and mainly related with work by the Polish school, Sanciada, for instance, and by Tony Corner from Oxford. Okay, so the answer to this question is yes, you can do this, but this group here is just is a locally free group, which means, which is a very weak condition, namely, this means every element in the group can only finitely often be divided by primes, not infinitely often, so this is just means locally free. Eklof and Mechler pose the question, can you replace this M, which is just locally free, at least by a dual group? And well, One can do more, but well, you have to assume Martin's axiom, and then you get, in fact, you can use a reflexive group, which is automatically is a dual group, which has this property. Namely, that if you add one copy of the integers, you get something not isomorphic. Well, if you look at this, then you see, oh, there are actually two questions. There's this question and there's this question. And you have to look for the grandfather of these two questions. And so it's very natural. This is our starting point to look at these two questions and find the common grandfather. And this is a central part of my talk. It's in a joint paper with Agnes Paris, who got a PhD at Connecticut. But she lives in the Philippines now. Namely, but again, using Martin's axiom, we can find a reflexive group such that M, take your favorite natural number, M, you can find a reflexive group where the M has to be coded into, such that if you add a free group of rank N, then this is isomorphic if and only if M divides N. So this is the same thing, but it's, we have a smaller class of groups that you're looking at. So there are two natural questions about this. How do we get rid of Martin's axiom? We don't know. There's another one I will mention later on. Okay, let me indicate how one can do this. Well, you work, like Heike mentioned already, between the in this Beer-Spekke group, that's this thing. And I'll use Lustig-Fuchs notation. Every element in here is written as an infinite sum with a placeholder and an integer on front. So this is an infinite sum in general. And inside there you have those sums which are honor sums, finite sums. This is a free group and that's which sits in there. Then you have to fix your favorite natural number M. And you have to code this into this Beer-Spekke group right here. Well, and you do this by introducing a shift homomorphism. You say everybody goes to the right M steps, and this gives you a monomorphism in the Beer-Spekke group, which is not an automorphism, so you can't find the inverse, but you can find the right inverse, so that's why you call this 5 minus 1. So everybody has to be moved back, but those guys, poor guys, which sit in the first row, they just fall into the basement. And this way, there you have two endomorphisms, this one and that one. P automatically is a module over its endomorphism ring, and so if you just take everything which is generated by integers and these two homomorphisms, you get a subring of the endomorphism ring, and P becomes an R module. So this way you code the natural number M into the Beer-Spekke group. If one would have done this in the earlier papers, one could have shortened the proof by using then more obvious algebraic arguments for this. Okay. So this is one of the starting points. Then, since it's complicated to work with a Cartesian product of the integers, so the best full Beer-Spekke group, you usually would restrict yourself to a very natural subgroup. Namely, you take this direct sum which sits inside the product, take its closure under the Z-arctic, or if you want, under the P-arctic topology, and then cut this with the Cartesian product, which means this is the closure, the Z-arctic closure of the restricted direct sum inside the Cartesian product, which is you can easily view and visualize the elements. These are, if they are infinite, they get more and more divisible by all natural numbers or by all integers you can think of. So that's how you can see this. But moreover, you have a on the direct sum, you have a natural scalar product, namely those just coming from the direct sum by assigning for each pair of placeholders, if I and J is there, a tetrachronicle symbol. And this extends linearly to a map from the S cross S to the integer. So it's a kind of scalar product. If you extend this to the Z-R closure, and so you take that other closure here and there, then the image will no longer be an integer, it will be a proper periodic number, a Z-adic number. So this is how the thing looks like. Now the map which tells you everybody shifted from m places to the right or to the left, on this place perhaps k times, can be moved to the other side, and then you have, for the scalar product, something which you know from function analysis. You have an operator, and there you have a joint operator. So this phi minus k is in the sense of a joint operator to that thing. And if you replace this phi to the k by a linear combination of those things, so by an arbitrary element of in the ring, and you define your theta dash as the same thing, but replace the k by minus k, then you have a very well-known equation, an operator, and it's a joint operator on the other side. So the goal is to find a reflexive group which satisfies this condition down here. So the group you are interested in should sit between S purely inside the D. Purely is needed because then you don't have to worry about topology. If somebody sits pure inside, then the induced topology on the D from the D is the same as the topology, the Z-adic topology on the G. So you don't have to worry about continuity or whether this is seen with respect to D or with respect to G. Moreover, you need, and this is a Sabac condition, if you have a monomorphism and the quotient is a free group of rank N, well, since this is free, it's projected, it splits, and since eta is a monomorphism, this would mean that the G can be written as a copy of G plus a direct, a free sum N of size of rank N. Then the back condition which we had before requires that M must divide N, otherwise you have lost, you can give up. So, and that's precisely what you have to focus on, you have to find this, and you have to make sure that this is given to you by the combinatorics. So usually you would say, okay, if I want to prove something like this, well then consult Jensen or Dick Diamond or the weak diamond, the Devlin-Shellach, and then you predict function and then you get hold of this. And you rule out, while you do the construction, those monomorphisms that you don't want. But you can do this even better. You can also do this with Martin's axiom, and I will just tell you how this works. I will do the rest of my talk. So before we start with Martin's axiom, we first start with a family of pairs of pure subgroups sandwiched between the S and its and the Z-adic closure of S. They sit between there, and we have those pairs. This is basic to look at pairs. So they sit between. Then you want that the number M which we had from the back problem that is coded into the H's. So you require that the H's are R modules, but then the shifting by M is built in. Then, because you want to apply Martin's axiom, you also make sure that the size of these things is less than 2 to the r of 0. And then at the end you get something of size 2 to the r of 0. And since these things or the scalar product give you the candidates for linear maps. These are bilinear maps and they give you the linear maps. You want that these linear maps go into the integers. And you recall, if you take the Z-adic completion of this thing and you look at the extension of phi to D cross D, which will end up in the z-adic closure of the integer, so in the product of the p-adic integers. So the requirement sits, one of the requirements sits in here. You want to extend the scalar product in such a way that you, and you want to extend these groups in such a way that you, everything remains integers, not p-adic, proper p-adic integers. So that's what has to be done for you by Martin's axiom. Okay, so you also have to have, you need an order on these pairs, and this is natural. If you have one pair and another pair, then they are ordered if both components are contained in each other. So the first component is contained in this first component, the second in this one. And then this P becomes a poset. And then you have to control these homomorphisms in order to do the Sebbak condition. And you have to translate this into somebody should tell you which homomorphisms you have to avoid. And you do this in the following way. They take any homomorphism from S to D. You know that this is the D is just z-adic closure. So by continuity, every homomorphism would extend uniquely. So if you know the homomorphism on the direct sum, it's already determined for the rest of your life. So it's enough if you look at homomorphisms from S to D. And you say that they are essentially in R, if you find an element in R such that this guy and this element in R act the same on the placeholders almost everywhere. Why almost? Yeah, because in the Beer-Specker group you have always these projections to finitely many components and you can't get hold of them. So you only have the chance to do something if you say almost. You can't say here for all. It's impossible. So you wouldn't like to leave these all, this would be left over. So in other words, if you have a homomorphism which is not essential, then it's undesirable. And you must get rid of those, and this is will come from Martin's axiom. So the whole construction works this way. You do a transfinite construction of these pairs, make them bigger and bigger, take unions at limit ordinals, so that at the end you get groups, pairs of groups of cardinality 2 to the I of 0. But on the way, you have a pair like H1 and H2, and you have to fulfill certain tasks. Namely, you have to find an element, A, which you have to throw into H1 or accordingly into H2. So let's restrict H1. If you just say this, it sounds simple, but it's not, because if you throw this element into H1, you purify and fix it, or ring multiples also in there. But even if you would ignore this, the difficulty is this new thing should belong to this collection of pairs. And the crucial condition was the scalar product on these pairs should have integer values and not p-adic numbers. But if you have an infinite vector and you throw this infinite vector A in here and you just take a scalar product with another infinite vector there and you take this infinite sum which comes, you very likely you would end up with a proper p-adic integer. So that's why Martin's axiom helps. Moreover, you need some more tasks. One is for a given map, or for a given vector, infinite vector, which is not in H2, you do want that the scalar product is outside. But the interesting thing is, you want to map A in case eta is an undesirable homomorphism. If you throw this into the H which was given to you before, then the image of this element should not be a linear combination of the old stuff and that new element. So that's how you formulate this condition. Now you have to do this, translate this into the setting of Magnus' axiom, and see how this works. And well, this is just repetition of what I had before. Well, one can distinguish under Seibel homomorphisms, there are two kinds. Either there's no element in R such that the difference of that undesirable homomorphism is any R element in R has infinite rank. So then this is this is an extreme case. So then the eta, I call it a stray. So it's a very heavy moving homomorphism. But it could also be that this condition is isolated, and the homomorphism is still of the wrong kind. Namely, if you find an eta such that the difference gives you an f, and on infinitely many components, the f is still not zero. So this is the other case, which are the cases you have to look at, which is not true. So now, you have to find this a, which you want to attach or include into the subgroup H1. So this is one of these sequences in here, if you have the omega down here. Then how do you do this? Well, it's Magnus' axiom, so it's a forcing notion. You look at finite pieces of it. So you take a finite piece, a finite subset of H2, and you have a finite piece of the sequence of A. So here's a finite sequence of the of that A, which goes up to a certain length LP. You make sure already on the way that everybody gets, when moving on, gets more and more divisible, because you won't end up in D, which are elements which get more and more divisible, so you have to do this. Why do you add this finite subset in here? Well, this guy at the end, when you build scalar products of A and somebody from the other side of the river, should be an element, should be an integer, not a periodic integer. So you have to make sure that all possible scalar products you build give you integers, and so that's why you have to have finite subsets of H2 for checking the extension of A. So the approximation has to give you scalar products in with integer values. That's why you have that thing. Then it has to get more and more divisible, because you should end up there, so you have to have this thing a priori. And then you have to have an ordering for Martin's axiom. So if you have this collection of these pairs, then you say that P and Q, two of them, they are ordered. Well, if the subsets are ordered, this is bigger, the second one, and the sequence is an extension, so it's the same on up to LP, and maybe there may be something else. And this is the crucial thing. That's why linear algebra again is needed. If you look at the scalar product up to, for the first vector with a guy from this finite set, and this extended first vector which goes up to Q, the scalar product should be the same value. Otherwise, if this would grow, then the scalar product easily could run into a proper periodic number, and then you are in trouble. So that's what you. These are the conditions you have to use for the Martin's axiom. So now, if you have that, then you first check whether this ordering is suitable. Well, it is. It's sigma directed. You just look at these pairs, and you look at an equivalence class. You call two guys equivalent if the sequences are the same. And then this is directed, and there are only countably many of those possibilities. So the F becomes a countable union of directed sets. So that's okay. And then you have to find your dense set, which give you those conditions which appear here. So particular that thing, namely that the scalar product ends in the integers, then this new guy, the new element, is disjoint, so to speak, up to the zero vector to a given set, because otherwise you have problems in extending the construction, and it has these properties. So and this means you have to set up your dense set for Arrhenius axiom. Well, at the end, you want to have an infinite vector, not a partial map, a total map. So you have to make sure that the map becomes total. You take your favorite ordinate, and you define a DL, which is all those P's in here, which includes L in the domain. And so this will make the map total. Then you have to make sure that this element, the new element, can be added to H1, which means on the other side, the scalar product has to have integer values. Then we have this dense set. Then you have to make sure, this was one of the conditions, that the scalar product with a given vector P is not an integer, and then you have to have a condition like this for every K. So you rule out that the infinite scalar product is not K, and thus you do for every K. These are countably many conditions. So that's how you get the scalar product is not an integer. Then in a similar way, you make sure that this new element is disjoint from a pre-assigned subset. And then you have to have two conditions which I don't want to discuss in detail. Namely, one, if the eta which is given to you, so eta is given, and eta can be either a stray, so which means the image with the difference of the images with any element in the ring is large, it's infinite ring, then you have to rule this out, so and you do this with this condition. And you have another condition, namely, if this is not a stray, so a better behaving and homomorphous, but still different from zero, these differences are still infinitely often non-zero, then you also have to rule those things. And if you have done this, then you have the two cases of homomorphisms into the integers ruled out. So this is your set of dense subsets of F which you look at, and the thing is you have to prove that these are dense subsets. And the advantage of Martin's axiom is usually if you wouldn't have Martin's axiom, then you would automatically run in infinite systems of linear equations. Now, because of this setting, you end up with finitely many equations. And then you can work with matrices. You can make sure that in either case, the density holds, but I don't want to go into the details of this. But this is just linear algebra. It reminded me of what Heike said before, namely, you have to have a function which becomes constant quite a while, and then you go up like this. And this is the same thing what you do here in order to show that such an A exists. And then with this, you get the following result, which works in set of C plus Martin's axiom. Namely, you can find two subgroups of the Bisch-Becker group, which are sandwiched between S and the completion, or the closure of S, which are Aleph 1-3, which is automatic, because these are subgroups of the Bisch-Becker group, and Specker already proved that subgroups of the product of the integers are Aleph 1-3, which means all countable subgroups are free. But you have to show that they are also slender, because you need this for arguments or this wash notion. And you have a bilinear map which goes from H1 cross H2 into the integers, and which is induced like this. And the dual group is induced by this bilinear map. So the things that you get on the other side are just the bilinear forms with a fixed entry on one side, and the other way around. These two groups are reflexes, because H1 star is this, H2 star, you are back to the first thing. After starring this twice, you are at H1. Since you code everything, you code your number m into this, you automatically get that if you add a free group of rank n, then this is isomorphic to Hi, either of the two, if and only if m divides n. Moreover, you can also control the endomorphisms or the endomorphism ring of the Hi's, and they are minimal in the sense where the Hi contains already the homomorphisms which are shifts by m, because they have to be there because it's an R module. But this is essentially all, namely, you automatically have in the endomorphism ring these projections to finite rank pieces, because you just project to the first 20 coordinates, for instance. And so you have an idea of those homomorphisms, endomorphisms, with finite rank image. So that's what it's called. So there's an ideal. So if you look at the endomorphism ring and model out the ideal, then you get just that ring which we introduced at the beginning, or since it's a ring split extension, you can write it, the endomorphism ring, as R plus direct this ideal. And so this is what one can say about the Sabak problem and the problem mentioned in Eklof-Meckner. What we don't know is how can we get rid of Magnus axiom, because we have no, it may be wrong, but it's by no means clear how one can get rid of this, because then one automatically runs in solving infinite systems of linear equations, and we haven't learned this in linear algebra. Okay, thank you.